This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalist Michael Ignatieff spent a year traveling to the sites of volatile regional wars. He wanted to learn how war is changing and what that means for the safety of relief workers. In a recent New Yorker article called Unarmed Warriors, he wrote about the International Committee of the Red Cross, the new risks its unarmed members face in war zones, and the new controversies surrounding the group's position of neutrality. Ignatieff's book, The Warrior's Honor, will be published at the end of the year. Ignatieff is the author of an earlier book about the new nationalism which is behind many of today's wars. I asked him why he wanted to write about the Red Cross.
Well, I've been out in the battle zones of the post-Cold War world for a number of years as a journalist, and I kept running across these earnest young Swiss, mostly men, in white Toyota Land Cruisers, and I was first simply curious as to what they did. They were very standoffish, very professional. They had a superb reputation. They didn't mix with journalists. They were regarded with a certain suspicion, and I had a sense of them as a breed apart. I think people in the United States may not be aware just how enormous the movement of international aid workers out there in the world is. There are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, many of them American, who spend their lives or a couple of years of their lives out in very difficult and dangerous places. And some of the most interesting of those people are the Red Cross workers. They seem to have a very, very high esprit de corps, a certain kind of Swiss standoffishness. As a group, I was very drawn to them because I thought they could take me into the whole world of what involves people in that kind of humanitarian relief work. And then I began to discover, in fact, that they were standoffish and apart, not simply because they were Swiss and because they'd been around for a very long time. The organization was founded in the 1860s, which make it almost the oldest of these international humanitarian organizations. But they were also enforcing what I came to see as a different morality. I mean, their job is to enforce something called the Geneva Conventions. And the Geneva Conventions are the kind of legal code behind the contemporary laws of war. And I began to, from being interested in the Red Cross, I then became interested in the laws of war and came to see that the laws of war are a very different moral tradition than, say, the human rights tradition. And I began to see that there are two traditions at work out there in the humanitarian movement. One of them is, you know, international human rights, which most Americans can identify with. And then there's this very different tradition called the laws of war tradition, which is basically trying to make sure that if people are going to fight, conduct the fighting according to certain rules. And that's what the Red Cross is trying to do.
Well, in fact, the neutrality of the International Red Cross is sometimes criticized by human rights groups who see that neutrality as being an inappropriate moral position during times of genocide.
Indeed, and one of the sort of moments in the modern consciousness came, or the modern conscience of the humanitarian movement came in, I think it was 1969, during the Biafra Civil War, in which the Biafrans were a secessionist group in Nigeria who succeeded, and they were put under blockade and international blockade, and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Igbo tribesmen were killed. It's an experience of genocide that many people have forgotten. A lot of aid agencies came into that area. It was the first of the kind of televisual disasters of the modern era. And in the middle of that crisis, the International Committee of the Red Cross was very involved, and one of the delegates of the International Red Cross, a young man, young doctor called Bernard Kouchner, a Frenchman, was so enraged by the fact that the Red Cross appeared to be neutral between the Nigerian government, which was brutalizing these Igbos, and the Igbos, felt that no neutrality was possible. He ripped off his Red Cross armband and said, "As a doctor, I cannot be neutral." And he went on to found a rival organization called Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Frontiers, which is working all over the world. But that rather dramatic moment shows that there are two contesting traditions here. One of them was the Red Cross, which says, you know, if we have to deal with Serbian paramilitaries and their victims, we'll deal with both. And other human rights groups, which feel you simply can't deal with the perpetrators and the victims on equal terms. It's a very, very strong debate about ethical neutrality, and the Red Cross takes a very firm position that the only way it can reach the victims is if it's strictly neutral between perpetrators and victims, if it doesn't make moral judgments about who's innocent and who's guilty in these zones.
Until recently, the neutrality of the Red Cross had guaranteed a certain degree of safety for Red Cross workers. Their neutrality was usually respected by both parties in a war, but that's less and less the case. Their neutrality is often not respected, and now Red Cross workers are getting shot point blank. What's the most chilling example of that you can think of?
Well, 1996 was a particularly bad year in the Red Cross's history. I mean, it has to be said that Red Cross workers have been targeted in the past, but last year in Chechnya, just before Christmas, in a hospital that had been declared neutral by all the combatants in the Chechen civil war, or the Chechen war between the Russians and the Chechens, there were six nurses from many countries asleep in their beds, a paramilitary group wearing masks and carrying weapons with silencers got into the dormitory, went from room to room, shooting these nurses, most of them women, middle-aged women, professional nurses, in their beds at such point-blank range that there were powder burns in their skulls. I mean, really savage professional execution. And that just shocked not only the Red Cross movement, that someone would gun down nurses in their beds asleep, but the whole international aid community realized or woke up to the fact that humanitarian aid workers can't count on their neutrality to protect them, can't count on their promises of being, you know, above the fray. They are in the fray, and they're being shot at.
Well, I think one of the things facing the Red Cross now, as the Red Cross tries to enforce the international laws of war, is that a lot of people fighting now not only aren't honoring those laws, they don't even know those laws exist.
Well, that's right. And one of the things that has happened to war in the 1990s is that it's being fought less and less by soldiers, by professional armies, by people trained in the use of weapons, trained in the laws of war, trained in the Geneva Conventions. It's being fought more and more by paramilitaries and by irregulars, and in some cases by children. One of the things that I think people don't realize is just what the modern cheap weapon has done in the world. There is a kind of tide of junk weapons spreading through these collapsing societies, weapons so light, so easily used, so portable, so cheap to buy, that they can be put in the hands of 12-year-olds. And, you know, in Liberia, in Mozambique, in a number of these conflicts, and in Afghanistan, where I was in September, you're constantly meeting young teenagers, young boys without any beard on their cheeks, you know, with RPGs and Kalashnikovs. And these kids are not warriors. They haven't been trained in the codes and restraints of warrior discipline. And one of the reasons why war has become more savage and uncontrolled is that it's been being fought by kids.
Have you faced kids with weapons?
Well, I've been at checkpoints where people were terrifyingly young. I've been up a hillside in northern Iraq in a training camp run by the PKK, a Kurdish resistance group fighting the Turks, and watched a drill parade by a contingent of about 60 girls, and I use the word girls advisedly. I watched girls training who were so small, the girls were so tiny that the weapons, the M6, the Kalashnikovs, were in one or two cases taller than they were. So that's what you're dealing with. You're dealing with the militarization of children by these resistance groups, by these insurrections, by these nationalist movements. Often those kids are being recruited because they're orphans, because they've been displaced by some previous phase of the war. People have to remember that a lot of these wars have been going on, you know, for 20, 30 years. The Angolan Civil War went on for 30 years, and that meant that kids were growing up who only knew war as a way of life, who were sucked into it partly because of the attraction of the danger, but also partly because the militias pay a wage. It was a way to survive. Liberia, for example, the Liberian Civil War was fought very much by children who called themselves, you know, Captain Rambo and all this kind of stuff, and walked around, in fact, wearing Halloween masks. That's the new world of war. It's no longer a war being fought by professional soldiery, and that gives people who are trying to enforce the European laws of war, the Geneva Conventions tradition, real worries, because they don't know who's in charge anymore.
My guest is journalist Michael Ignatieff. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Ignatieff, his article Unarmed Warriors about the Red Cross workers in war zones was published in the March 24th edition of The New Yorker. Well, the International Committee of the Red Cross is trying to disseminate information about the Geneva Conventions, about the international laws of war. What are they trying to do? How are they trying to educate people who are fighting about these codes?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to back up a little and just understand what the codes are. There are these things called the Geneva Conventions, which were ratified by hundreds of countries in the basic document dates to 1864 and then revised in 1949. There are a bunch of rules that are quite simple. They simply say, don't fire on ambulances, don't shoot on non-combatants, don't torture prisoners, allow prisoners to communicate with their families, allow the Red Cross to visit you if you're a prisoner of war, spare civilians. I mean, they're very house and garden common rules, and in lots of combat situations, they function more or less adequately. The Gulf War, for example, when the 100,000 Iraqi prisoners were taken, the United States subscribed to the Geneva Conventions, released them according to those conventions. So it's a system that, you know, it's easy to laugh at. People say, you know, you can't wage a war that's civilized. Well, in fact, the Geneva Conventions have done a lot to civilize certain aspects of war, and so they have a lot of legitimacy. Now, in these new contexts, where you're dealing with non-European peoples, people who don't come from the European tradition, you have to do a lot of translating. And one of the places where the Red Cross has done a lot of work is to look at whether there are traditions within Islam, for example, that you can appeal to. So they've had scholars sit down and dig through the old ancient Quranic texts and the commentaries on the Quran and the recorded words of the Prophet, and they've tried to find a tradition that is something more than what the West knows of warrior traditions in Islam, which is jihad. When we think of Islam, we think of jihad. We think of the merciless Islamic warrior who spares nobody, who brings death to the infidel. There is, in fact, another tradition in Islam, which is that, you know, you behave with decency and manliness and courage and honor towards your victims. And that tradition is perhaps best symbolized by the warrior King Saladin, who captured the crusading king, Richard Coeur de Lion, during the Crusades in the 13th century, and spared him and treated him with mercy and respect. So wherever the Red Cross goes, they try to appeal to Islamic warriors and remind them of Saladin, remind them of the traditional injunctions in the Quran to be merciful, to spare the flocks and womenfolk and children of the enemy and all that stuff. And I think something very interesting is going on there, an attempt to say the standards of decency that ought to prevail in the world are not white, Western European values. They're human universals. And if you look deeply enough into your own traditions of warrior culture, you will find them. And that's what the Red Cross is trying to do. They're just beginning that work, but they're putting out comic books that tell the story. They're running radio soap operas to tell the story. They're not just sitting there reading out the Geneva Conventions. They're trying to translate them into new languages. And it's one of the most interesting bits of work that's going on.
You actually reprint a couple of paragraphs from ancient Quranic texts that the Red Cross has used.
Yes.
And let me quote what you've reprinted. If you are victorious over them, do not stab them in the back. Do not kill the wounded or uncover their genitals. Do not mutilate the dead. Do not tear a veil. And then from another text, abstain from treachery, abstain from transgressing limits, abstain from betrayal, abstain from killing small children, old men or women, abstain from cutting palm trees, abstain from slaughtering sheep or cows or camels except to feed yourselves. So that's examples of older Islamic writing that the Red Cross is trying to use to convince people to follow a certain code of decency.
Yes,
during
times
of war.
I think what I'm trying to get at here is that it's a sort of counterintuitive thought. One of the oldest moral traditions that all human societies have is the warrior tradition, the tradition of warrior's honor. The idea that a warrior has a very dangerous and therefore sacred responsibility. That is, his job is to protect the community and to engage in the infliction of death. Because that's a very dangerous and very serious task, men have to be trained for it. And they're trained not to simply unleash their aggression, but to control it and to discipline it and, you know, and use it for the benefit of the community. And those traditions then mean that there are certain people you can kill and there are certain people it's wrong to kill. There are certain ways of waging war that are honorable and certain ways of waging war that are dishonorable. Most modern military forces attempt in some way or the other to subscribe to those very ancient codes. And I think we forget, in the 20th century, partly because war has become so awful and so horrible and so devastating, we've come to equate war with pure barbarism and pure savagery. It seems to us to be a zone where morality cannot prevail at all. And so it's a rather counterintuitive thought that, in fact, the warrior's honor is one of the oldest moral traditions in the world. And the Red Cross is trying, in a way, to simply institutionalize that culture, remind people that in their own cultures they can find elements of a warrior's honor which should restrain their people. And I'm a child of the 60s and marched against the Vietnam War and was very marked by that experience in moral terms. I was led to believe that war was always a moral abomination. I suppose as I've got older, I've seen that you often can't abolish war altogether. All you can do is attempt to contain it within certain limits, and there's no necessary reason why war should be synonymous with savagery.
How are Red Cross workers trained to deal with gunmen and child soldiers and checkpoints?
Well, their training has changed a lot in the last 15 years. If you sign up for the Red Cross as a young Swiss citizen, they're now accepting non-Swiss nationals, including a few Americans. You go on a training course outside Geneva where they put you through a mock hijack. They put you in a Toyota Land Cruiser in the dark and run you up to a checkpoint, and people with masks jump out and try and get in the car. And you're taught how to jump away from a vehicle if it's under a mortar fire or attack. You're also taught the very strict rules that the Red Cross have about weapons. Never under any circumstance transport an armed fighter of any side inside a Red Cross vehicle. All Red Cross vehicles have this little decal on all the doors which shows a light automatic weapon crossed off to make clear to all sides that their vehicles are always and invariably unarmed. So the new delegate is taught all those things. But at the end of the day, their survival out there, and some of these places are very, very dangerous, depend on having good contacts with local militiamen and having this reputation for being neutral. Their whole safety depends ultimately on people believing in that Red Cross emblem and respecting it. And the trouble is nowadays people don't. The crisis of the Red Cross, if there is one, is a crisis of the legitimacy of its emblem. And its emblem, you know, is, you know, next to Coca-Cola or Marlboro, is probably the most famous logo in the world. But it's a moral logo, you know, and what it means is don't fire at this symbol. And the trouble now is that people are firing at the symbol. And that has the organization very, very concerned.
Do you think that there are fighters in some countries that really don't even recognize the logo in spite of the fact of how famous it is?
Yes, I think there's certain people who for complicated reasons don't recognize it. The Red Cross logo in Yugoslavia used to be used as a symbol by the Federal Ministry of Defense ambulances, and since, you know, the Croatians were breaking away from Yugoslavia, the Red Cross was a Yugoslav symbol that they rejected. So there are situations like that where the symbol is delegitimized. There are other occasions where it's delegitimized because it's held to be a Western symbol, although in Islamic countries the organization is known as the Red Crescent Society, so that you don't use a Christian symbol. But I think beyond that, there is a deeper crisis. And I think it's not that people don't recognize the legitimacy of the symbol. It's that these groups recognize that firing it on the symbol will get them attention. And that's what's scary, the sense that the best way to get the media to pay attention to your demands in Chechnya is to kill 6 nurses. The best way to derail the peace process in Chechnya, which has just gone underway, is to kill some international aid workers. This isn't a crisis of legitimacy that's just affecting the Red Cross. It's affecting all humanitarian agencies out there. Humanitarian workers are discovering that they're taken hostage more frequently, they're threatened more frequently, they're killed more frequently, and that's because these groups use humanitarian aid workers as political counters to trade, to sell, to kill, to use in their own political games, and that's what's frightening.
Michael Ignatieff's article about the International Committee of the Red Cross was published in the March 24th edition of The New Yorker. He'll be back in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.